Well, Gary, I was reading your article on habeas corpus, and there were some aspects to it that I wanted to ask you about. I remember you were citing some court cases regarding the different kinds of what seemed to be different kinds of citizenship. So I guess my first question is, are there two classes of American citizenship?
Well, I believe that there are, and the United States Supreme Court, as recently as 1908, 40 years after the 14th Amendment, believed that there were state citizens. So my opinion is basically worthless, but the Supreme Court, we've got to recognize that those guys know what they're talking about. So yes, there are two classes of citizens in this country.
So you're saying that the federal courts recognize that there are two classes of citizenship?
Yes, there was a case called Twining versus State of New Jersey. It was heard by the Supreme Court in 1908. It went up from the New Jersey court, and it was, for those interested, the site is 211 U.S. 78. 211 U.S. 78, Supreme Court decision. But what it amounted to is Twining and his partner Cornell had been running a business, and the New Jersey Banking Commission wanted to review their books and said, "You got to bring your books." So they took their books down and they were reviewed, and then they had done some wrong and they were convicted. So they appealed to the United States Supreme Court and said that the books were taken without due process of law. And the decision then by the court basically was, well, if you are citizens of New Jersey, well, they claim to be citizens of New Jersey, and the court said, if you are such, then the case ends here. We can't deal with this. It doesn't, the 14th Amendment due process does not extend to you. You're under the purview or the jurisdiction of the state. And so that was an acknowledgement that they would not extend the due process protection of the 14th Amendment to Twining and Cornell because they were state citizens, citizens of New Jersey. So yeah, there's two classes of citizen.
Okay, well that's at the federal level though. I mean, what about the different state governments? I mean, let me put it this way. What of the American state governments recognize in their own law that there are two classes of citizenship?
Well, I don't think you'll find it now. Most constitutions have been rewritten since the 1900s or revised to an extent. And it's kind of a shoddy deal. Some states do it on the ballot, and do you want this new amendment, and do you want to repeal that amendment? So things disappear over time. But the states never had to declare a recognition of state citizenship within their constitution. There was no reason for it, because until the 14th Amendment, people were citizens of a state, or they weren't. And if they weren't, they weren't citizens. And therefore, they couldn't even go to the courtroom. And this occurs in cases like Dred Scott v. Sanford, where Sanford had no legal right. I mean, Dred Scott had no legal right to go to the Supreme Court, but Sanford didn't object timely to that. So the court said, "Oh, well, we can't really hear this, but since you're here and since Sanford did not object timely, we'll hear this case." And so they heard it. And but the states never had a reason to defend that position. But then 1908, that was 106 years ago. So the states have lost sight. There's a case, I think it's Dyett v. Turner, and I don't have it in front of me. But it was from Idaho, and basically Idaho Supreme Court said we can't even enforce our own constitution because we're dictated to by the United States government and the United States Supreme Court. So the concept of state citizenship has been left by the wayside. It's not been destroyed, it's just been kind of abandoned by the governments, both the state and the federal, since then.
Okay, so then what is state citizenship exactly?
Well, until the 14th Amendment, the United States government granted citizenship to nobody. The states granted citizenship, and each state had their qualifications. They determined what was a state citizen. They were citizens of the United States. Now, I've talked to you about this before. There are three United States. This is in Black's Law Dictionary, is from a Supreme Court decision where the United States faces the rest of the world as the sovereign of the country, and that's as it should be. Everything outside of our boundaries is faced by the United States government. Then there's the United States, which is the land owned by the United States and ceded to them in Washington, D.C., forts, magazines, arsenals, and other needful buildings. And the third one is citizen of one of the member states of the Union. Well, not citizen of, is the member states of the Union, the United States. There are 50 United States, 50 states united by the Union. And so what we're talking about is citizens of one of those 50 United States being a state citizen. Now, the 14th Amendment, some argue that that did away with it, but, well, let's see what the 14th Amendment says. All persons born or naturalized and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Well, I think the government exceeded their authority by extending them state citizenship because the states are supposed to be autonomous units. But let's look at that. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So if you were subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, it would impose United States citizenship, U.S. citizen, on you. Let's call that the 14th Amendment citizenship. It would impose that on you if you were subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. When we talked about habeas corpus, I mentioned a number of cases where there was an absence of jurisdiction on the part of the federal government. One of those was in 1833. It was called Barron versus City of Baltimore. And Barron had a wharf, and the City of Baltimore, and he could take deep draft ships into his wharf and unload cargo, and he charged to unload cargo and things like that. So Baltimore did some dredging, and when they did that, they put the spoil up in front of his wharf, and he could not get the deep draft ships anymore. He could only take shallow draft ships. So this damaged him, his property considerably, and so he went to the United States Supreme Court, went to the Baltimore court first, and they ruled against him, so he went to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, well, we can't help you because you're a citizen of Baltimore and you're under Baltimore's constitution. The federal constitution is only deals with the relationship between you and the federal government, and we had nothing to do with the dredging, and we cannot impose the taking provision of the Constitution without just compensation. We cannot impose that on the state of New Jersey, and we can't protect you. So obviously, Barron was not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States because they couldn't help him. He was subject to the jurisdiction of Maryland. And there are other cases that deal with the same thing, where the person is not subject to federal jurisdiction, and unless there was a nexus to the federal government, to the Constitution, the court said, we can't help you. Now, the only reason they can't help us is we're not subject to their jurisdiction. The courts of England can't help us. The courts of Mexico can't help us. And the United States federal courts can't help us unless it's dealing with something where I have a relationship with the federal government, or there's a nexus, a constitutional nexus, that being a power or a grant of authority to the federal government. And Dred Scott's a good example. The Congress enacted the Fugitive Slave Act, and people argued that you can't do that. You know, that's unconstitutional. However, the Constitution has provisions that require criminals to be returned to the state wherein they committed the crime, and a fleeing slave has definitely committed a crime. He's stolen the property from his owner. And it also required that the slaves be returned to their master if they're caught in another state. So the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was just a codification of dealing with the process of returning slaves and punishment for failure to abide by the Constitution. So it was an authority, a power and authority granted to the federal government. So that jurisdiction exists because that person violated the federal constitution to the extent that the powers and authorities were granted by the constitution.
Well, considering what you just said about the 14th Amendment and its specific wording, you know, I have to ask, is state citizenship a distinction without a difference, especially vis-a-vis United States citizenship?
It appears to be now, because the courts haven't recognized it. You know, we did the habeas corpus asserting that both Larry Michael Myers and myself were state citizens, but they refused to hear the case, even though it's guaranteed by the Constitution, right of habeas corpus. They refused to hear the case. So we did not get a hearing on whether there's merit to the distinction between the two classes of citizen or not.
Hmm. Okay. Well,
so yes, at this point in time, that's a distinction without a difference. However, I can't find a law that is, or a decision that establishes that it's a distinction without a difference.
Well, since we're discussing the 14th Amendment here, what is the significance of the 14th Amendment, especially as it pertains to state citizenship?
Well, in my research, many cases like Barron versus Baltimore, even after Barron versus Baltimore, like Twining, says you're a state citizen. And by that allows that, unlike the 14th Amendment that made them a citizen of the United States and a state citizen, they're just a state citizen. Therefore, the federal government can't intercede. Other cases where somebody's admittedly a 14th Amendment citizen, then the United States government can intercede on their behalf via the court system.
Hmm. Well, there are some people that make some claims whenever the 14th Amendment is even brought up, so I hate to ask this, but in the interest of fairness, is the entire notion of state citizenship, as explained by the judicial branch of government, inherently bigoted, as some have alleged, per the 14th Amendment?
Well, the 14th Amendment was bigoted. In my research on the 14th Amendment, for example, I went through, I don't remember how many pages, many tens of thousands of words of the congressional record in the Senate, where they were discussing the 14th Amendment. They never mentioned white people. They did mention Chinese. They mentioned these other non-white people. They talked about Negroes. They talked about, and now, interestingly, some of them said, well, I thought we were doing this just for the Negroes. And they didn't really say, no, we're not, but the discussion continued. They even addressed Indians, and it, rather interestingly, because Indians, if they were on the reservation, were not brought in under the 14th Amendment. But if they had moved into the cities and towns and began to assimilate as part of the United States, then they were granted that citizenship by the 14th Amendment. But whites are not mentioned. So, yeah, it's probably bigoted because it did not include white people. Not that I'm objecting. But I would say that the 14th Amendment was very bigoted because it was very specific in bringing people who had never previously been considered citizens in this country into the rights and privileges of people in this country. Now, you've read my article, We the People, But Who Are We?
Yeah.
And, you know, this nation was established on some certain principles. And the common heritage, the common culture, the heritage being Europe, the culture rather more diverse because you had all these European cultures, but primarily the Anglo-Saxon. The English culture was brought here, and the language was English. Foreigners, Frenchmen, anybody else came over here, they learned English. And so there was a common element of heritage, culture, and language. And remember, in Europe, everybody was under a monarchy at one time, and England was the first one to kind of step away from the monarchies controlled by the Catholic Church, and slowly other countries began to do it. To some degree, the city-states, French Revolution 10 or so years after ours. So there was a shift. And so there was a constancy within Europe in progression vis-a-vis religion, type of government, things like that. Some were slower, some were faster, but the common elements were there. And the 14th Amendment then stirred that pot drastically, taking away from it the elements that are necessary for the integrity of a nation, being the common language, the common heritage, and the common culture.
Yeah, and actually, just to remind me about that, I mean, wasn't We the People, But Who Are We, that series you wrote, wasn't that based on Dred Scott versus Sanford?
Yes, it was.
Justice Taney's decision? Okay.
Justice Taney went into great detail in explaining who we the people are. And he did not include any of those that were not we the people. The 14th Amendment did not make them part of we the people. It gave them citizenship, but it did not make them we the people. And so then if we look at history with exceptions, and one of them being the freed slaves, but over the years, most people wanted to, that came here, immigrants came here, they wanted to assimilate into society. You know, I've got a step-grandfather that came over here, jumped a French ship in New York Harbor, and basically hid out until he found an American girl to marry. When he married her, his citizenship was assured. But the first thing he did was learn English. And then he opened a business. And he carried that business from New York to Cincinnati to Los Angeles, California, and did quite well in it. But they assimilated. They wanted to be. They kept some of their heritages, their Italian-American clubs, German-American clubs, where they speak German or Italian or English. But in daily life, they spoke English, except the older people that were too old to learn a new language. Like me, I don't want to learn a new language at my age. But the younger people wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be Americans. They didn't want to come here and get gifts, everything for free. They wanted to come here because the opportunity to build something existed here. They learned English, and like my step-grandfather, they wanted to build something. They wanted to make a life for themselves that they couldn't make in their country. That was the draw, because opportunity existed here. That opportunity now is, you know, budding in line to get a handout for free. It's not based on assimilation anymore.
You know, funny you should mention assimilation and your step-grandfather. On one side of one branch of my family, in one sense, there were some Irish immigrants, and they, when they got to New York City, they couldn't speak Gaelic anymore. They had to learn English.
They're shipped in the private home.
Of but course.
They didn't have to, but they had to get along, right?
Is yes. Well, yeah. They were in New York City, yeah. Kind of had to if you're living in the squalor tenements, yeah.
But I would suggest they probably wanted to. Why did they come here if they didn't want to learn English?
Right. All right, well.
Now, you know, I didn't know that. I always thought you were one of those, what's that word, mongrel, that's it.
Well, European mutts, yes, but one of the elements of the mutts were the Irish. The notion of assimilation has been kind of prominent in my family anyway.
Yeah, and in New York, the Irish had to occupy the same ghettos because they were frowned upon, but they managed to come through quite strongly because they chose to assimilate. Even though they had to group together like they did, they chose to assimilate.
Okay.
They already had the language, but they wanted to be Americans. In fact, look at the Revolutionary War had a few Irish, but at the Civil War had a lot of Irish brigades, quite a few, I should say, not a lot. But they were fighting for the Union. They were fighting. They volunteered. They fought for the Union, but as an Irish brigade, they kept the autonomy of their heritage, their unique heritage.
Yeah, and speaking of a different war, there was the during the Texas War for Independence, there were the Tejanos, the native inhabitants of Texas before it was Texas, and one of the most notable ones was Juan Seguin, and so yeah, you just like no, he was it was again it was based on assimilation, a lot of it was anyway, so.
Well, in the Mexican War, too, there was an Irish brigade that fought for Mexico against the Americans, and I think when they were captured, they were killed.
If I remember correctly.
So
I think you're right about that.
Bad decision on their part to fight for the Mexicans.
Speaking about the after effects of various wars on this continent, I did want to ask you, what effect did Reconstruction have upon state citizenship?
At the time, absolutely none. But what it did do is it created a stronger central government, even beyond the imagination of a guy named Alexander Hamilton. I think 10 of the 11 seceding states were put under martial law and kept there until they achieved all these elements. They had to hold elections, they had to have a convention, adopt a constitution, ratify the 14th Amendment, and then maybe they could become a state again. However, to get there, and here's the effect that it did have indirectly, the 14th Amendment was prohibitive. Now, the Constitution gives the president the right to grant amnesty or pardon. And Andrew Johnson did that. And Congress turned around in the amendment with an ex post facto law and undid the amnesty and put all these hurdles, oaths and everything else. These people, well, they had to take the oath on the amnesty, on the pardon, but put all these obstacles in the way of those that had fought or been a part of the Confederate States government. So these guys, for the most part, weren't allowed to vote, while at the same time they were allowing the Negroes to vote. And here you've got people that are basically illiterate. They have no concept of government except the guy with the whip's the boss, and I do what he says. And now they're given the right to form a state government, to ratify a constitution that's put before them, to ratify the 14th Amendment, and then seek statehood returned to them by the federal government. So the state citizens at that time, the people that fought for their side during the war and lost, state citizenship meant absolutely nothing. It didn't change the nature of it, as we saw in Twining, 40 years later, but non-state citizens became the people that created the constitutions in the respective states. Of course, they had a lot of help from these guys coming from the north down to make a profit, carpetbaggers and scalawags and people like that. But, Lincoln with Louisiana had allowed Louisiana to progress on its own on restoring its government. In fact, his last speech was talking about, we don't know if it's going to work or not, but it's progressing. There's no sense in undoing it. Let's see what happens. That's basically what he said in a speech on April 11th, just shortly before he was assassinated. And I think that he would have done that with the state, other state governments, allowed them to progress back up as long as they didn't get out of line, let it go. But if they got out of line, put them back in line, but let them progress on their own, not have the federal government come in and mandate. But Thaddeus Stevens and people like him were vindictive. They had suggested at various times that anybody who fought for the South, especially the officers, should be hung. They were vindictive. And they are the ones that really destroyed the country. They pushed the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, and they also overrode the veto of when Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Act, and Johnson, in vetoing the Civil Rights Act, said this is not constitutional. It won't work without an amendment. They overrode the veto, and a couple of years later came up with the 14th Amendment, which was the wording of the Civil Rights Act. It gave the rights to these people. So they acknowledged after overriding the veto that it did require constitutional change. But that's how nasty, how vindictive Thaddeus Stevens and those radical Republicans were. So,
wow.
It didn't have an effect on state citizenship, but it suppressed the states until new governments were formed. And look what it led to. The Ku Klux Klan evolved out of that, trying to protect the white people against this intrusive, obsessive, vindictive slave population, those bad slaves, ex-slaves that maybe had been tormented, that wanted to punish the whites. And so it was a retaliatory thing. And the states, when they could, would pass laws that Negroes couldn't have guns. And my understanding is the National Rifle Association evolved from making sure that Negroes had guns, could have guns. But I'm not sure of that. I just throw it in there.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's kind of a separate topic that would be worth getting into some other time. But something about citizenship that I wanted to ask you is that, as far as I understand it, citizenship, at least under a Republican form of government, requires its citizens to consent to its governance. So is the consent of the governed of a collective or individual nature?
Well, there are those that follow the fictional Lysander Spooner concept of our relationship with government. But the consent of the government it has to be collective. It's limited by the constitutions, both state and federal, on what they can do and can't do. They can't violate rights retained. You know, every state has a Bill of Rights, even though it might be called something else. You know, Texas has theirs. They have 39, I think, different articles in the Bill of Rights. But yes, the collective is the collective. It's based upon a majority. In fact, in most cases, ratification requires two-thirds majority. There are some cases in government where three-quarters is necessary. So, yes, a simple majority up to three-quarters is necessary to represent that collective will. It can't be individual. In defense of right, it can be individual if the document says it's there. Man, you've got every right. But how else can consent be determined? And, you know, you and I have talked about the ratification process. Everybody thinks the Philadelphia conspiracy and these bunch of rich dudes went in there.
Oh, no.
And conspired to create this evil government, and then they foisted it on the American people, ignoring the fact that one of the articles required that nine states ratify this before it was any more than just a piece of paper.
Right, and also
states ratified it.
And it also, ignored the Philadelphia conspiracy argument, ignored the fact that the anti-federalists, so-called anti-federalists, in the end acquiesced to what the federalists wanted, which is rather important.
Well, to some extent. I mean, the anti-federalists won in convention on a number of issues. It went back and forth. If you read, Madison wrote the most thorough analysis, but at least three different analyses of the convention have been since been published, and it was give and take. I mean, Hamilton lost a lot of things he wanted, so it went back and forth. It wasn't just that group of people. Now, interestingly, out of that, understand the times, there was social superiority in those that held office. These people had socially distinguished themselves. They were wealthy. There were a few exceptions of away from family wealth. Ben Franklin is probably the best example. Almost all the rest, and Hamilton kind of, you know, he worked his way up. So he was kind of had to earn his social superiority. But that social superiority prior to the Constitution also granted political superiority. And until the Constitution, even most of the states still held that only certain people are qualified socially and politically to have positions of influence. But by adopting the Constitution and the subsequent changes in the state constitutions, the idea of social superiority was extinguished, and the idea of political superiority was extinguished. So these people destroyed the underpinnings of their power by bringing the Constitution to us. Now, if we look at Washington today, we see that social superiority and political superiority have returned to our government.
Unfortunately.
Very unfortunately.
Actually, speaking of acquiescence, can acquiescence be considered sufficient as giving one's consent to be governed?
If I told you to bow down and kiss my boots, and you acquiesced and did, you have given consent, and it will probably continue, wouldn't it? So yes, when you acquiesce, you tend to accept a condition that you didn't accept before acquiescence. And so now it's a norm, not inconceivable. So yes, once there's acquiescence, there's an acceptance of that new status quo. Unless and until reality hits you.
That almost sounds evocative of the legal maxim that silence is consent.
Well, that's a legal maxim, and that's a bit different. And remember, that doesn't apply to government. But it does apply to you. But silence can be consent, because if I charge you with stealing my pigs and you don't defend yourself, what's the jury to do? So from a legal standpoint, that acquiescence is consent. I mean, that silence is consent. You have to defend yourself. No, I didn't steal his pigs. I don't even have any pigs. Never have, never will. Don't like pork. I'm a Muslim. Oh, well, okay. Well, I guess, no, he didn't steal your pigs now. We know that. He's a Muslim. So silence is consent, or acquiescence is consent. It is. And the acquiescence actually grows on you, because once you take that first step, you've accepted something. But like I said, if at a point in time you realize that things ain't right, that doesn't mean, well, let me find a quote real quick here.
Well, something, you know, whether, well, I've noticed that different political philosophers have mentioned this, you know, everybody from Etienne de la Boetie to John Locke have mentioned the importance of acquiescence. Boetie specifically mentioned about how
let me address that. That whenever any form of government becomes destructing these ends being the protection of life, liberty, and property, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed, this is the point now, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer. All evils are sufferable. That's acceptance. That's the acquiescence. Than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. That's the status quo, the habitual acceptance. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. So that explains in a nutshell what we're talking about, doesn't it? That you accept
it.
You accept it. But at some point, you realize this ain't right. And at that point, you have the right, you have the duty to change that government.
Yeah, I mean, even Henry Thoreau, to a certain degree, even said it was a duty as well. And that way, he was he lived around like mid-19th century America. So
I kind of stay away from both Thoreau and Gandhi, but you're free to mention them.
Well, it's fair, but at least the concept, purely distilled with the ability of it, is still revolving around acquiescence. And I know John Locke, at length in his treatise on Second Treatise on Government, mentioned about more specifically about how acquiescence works, and so forth. But I guess that if consent can be given, that would also seem to imply that consent can be taken away. So I guess that would lead to this question, which is...
Well, no, consent can't be taken away. And let's go there. I wrote an article back, I think, in 1996 called Sons of Liberty Number 14, and it talks about dissolution of government. And I cannot divest myself of government. That would be withdrawal of consent, wouldn't it, if I divest myself of the government? Am I correct? If I withdraw consent, I divest myself of that government.
I would presume so.
Okay. So I can't do that. I can't withdraw that consent. I can try and change it, but we've seen how effective that's been since 2006, 2007, with the Tea Party coming on strong and achieving absolutely nothing. But let's look at what Locke said. He said that the government, if they violate their obligation under that contract of government called the Constitution, they have divested you of that government. They have breached the contract. So it's a one-way street. I can't withdraw my consent, but their obligation exists, and if they cease that obligation, they have divested me.
Well, I know Locke mentioned that it's a dissolution of government when they
That's what the Declaration of Independence is. It's actually a dissolution of government. And they, as they said, created a new government that serves them better than the English government, the English Constitution that they wanted the rights from. Those rights were denied by England, right?
Yes, the British Empire, yes.
There's the divestment. So they said, screw you, we accept that. But they call it Declaration of Independence rather than Declaration of Dissolution of Government.
Right,
and they did that. There's kind of a fine line here, but they didn't want the English Constitution. They felt they could do better. So, and they had the Articles of Confederation. They had a new government. So they had to create the independence. Now, in the case of the United States today, what I think we want is a dissolution of government to restore the Constitution, because it's a good document. It needs some amendments. Don't doubt that, because they've managed to get around a lot of things because of the brevity of the Constitution itself. But we're talking about dissolution of the de facto government, not the de jure government, because we want restoration of the de jure government.
Well, I was going to ask you the question about how can such consent to be governed be revoked, but now that you've mentioned about dissolution of government, it's...
Well, let's go there. Okay. No, because there are other aspects to this. And let's go back to that point in time that I recognize as something seriously wrong. Well, I'm a citizen of Florida. I was born in California, but I revoked my powers of attorney with the federal government in Florida, recorded in the public records. Not that it means a whole lot. That piece of paper and a dime will get – or no, $10 will get me a cup of coffee, but I don't drink coffee, so I – but – it was a declaration. Did it do any good? Can I take that into court and say, screw you, you can't mess with me? No, I can't do that. But what did it do for me? It gave me a state of mind, a recognition of the failure of the Constitution to protect me as it's supposed to. So I have entered a state of nature. Psychologically, I'm in that state of nature where I have no government. Now, wait. I drive with the driver's license and do other things to accommodate it. So I have to do in Rome as the Romans do. So for my own safety, I do certain things that I don't have to do. I proved I didn't have to drive with a license, but it's inconvenient. It costs time and money and things like that. But that state of nature is probably the most important part. John Adams, in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, said the Revolution, that was the period, the 10 years before 1775, when the letters and the newspapers of the day and the articles and the pamphlets were going through a revolution of state of mind. The war itself was simply a consequence of the success of that revolution, and that began in April 19, 1775. So the revolution occurred during that 10-year period from the end of the French and Indian Wars, basically, until the beginning of what we call the Revolutionary War. But the revolution was over once we went to arms. Now there was a war to accomplish what our minds had achieved. So when I talk about my state of mind being a state of nature, I'm there. I'm alone. or there's a few others, hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands. But at some point, the number of people that have achieved that state of nature of recognition of what our relationship is with the federal government and what it should be, and what our relationship is with the state government and what it should be, then we will have achieved the revolution, and now it's just a matter of the consequence of that revolution being expressed, hopefully not the same way it was in 1775 through 1781. There are other methods. My plan for restoration of constitutional government would be less bloody, but would achieve the same end if and when there's enough people that have entered the state of mind that that revolution, that changing of thought process, has been successful.
Okay, so that's why you named one of your articles The End of the Revolution, the Beginning of Independence.
Right, because historically we think the whole thing started on April 19th, 1775. But over a year before that, men were picking up rifles and going and forcing judges to resign. Now, I can't find any real bloodshed, no deaths in that, but injuries, yes. Destruction of property, yes. But yes, when I read that letter probably the fourth or fifth time from Adams to Jefferson, and it was 1815 or 1816, somewhere around then, it finally struck me that the revolution is the change in our process of thought. And then it's simply a matter to achieve what we have decided to gain. But yes, we think of everything started, oh, Boston Massacre and Boston Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Two little obscure little events. Not realizing that at one point in late 1774, some estimates have over 100,000 people marching towards Boston because they thought Boston had been burned to the ground by the British.
Mm.
And there was desperation. Gage and his people were trying to get the local patriots, call them off. We don't want this. And it was successful. They didn't march there, but it was called the Powder, Powder Keg March, something like that. But it's addressed in that article, End of the Revolution, Beginning of Independence. And so the change of mind was so strong that some at least were willing to pick up their rifles, but nobody fired back until April 19th. That's when the whole thing changed, because the spark was there, finally, and people rallied around that spark. There's a very good book written by, I think he's a socialist, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of the name of the book, but I've got it here somewhere. But anyway, it's about the April 19th and shortly prior to. And then also Lucy Hosmer's diary is on my blog somewhere. But these people are saying, we'll never go to war. This was said in Lexington and Concord. We'll never go to war with England. You know, they're our countrymen and all this. I understand the problem and all that. But when shots were fired on Lexington and Concord, people who thought that they would never take up arms against Britain and even expressed that they would never take arms up against Britain or England picked up their rifles. So they were along the line quite a ways, to the point that when reality hit them that this is going, as King George III said, this will come to blows. When it came to blows, they jumped over the fence and got on the colonist side of the battle. So it's an interesting transition that our history taught in school tends to ignore, which is this expansion of thought into action, into ultimately the shot heard around the world. There was a progression. And I think we're going through that progression right now. Look at this patriot community, how it grows. Go to Southern Poverty Law Center's webpage and see how many patriot organizations there are. And that's the ones they know about. How many underground cells are there? How many security teams? How many militia that don't go online or have yet to be fingered by SPLC? So, yeah, we're moving in the right direction. We just haven't gotten to the point of picking up our rifles and telling Common Core teachers to resign from the school board, school program, but maybe we will. Maybe we will tell judges who twist the Constitution to social engineering, forcing them to resign. But it's a lot more difficult because we have police departments now, not just British soldiers stationed down the road, and the police department can respond quickly. So, and again, the plan for restoration of constitutional government addresses this. We've got to emulate what the founders did. We've got to follow that progression to the end of the revolution and the beginning of our restoration of constitutional government along the lines that they did, but we've got to adapt that to the circumstances, the technology, and all the factors that exist today. But the first step is that one of recognition of a state of nature that I will acquiesce to the extent that I have to. But otherwise, I know my relationship with this government.
Well, it sounds more like you're being coerced rather than you necessarily acquiescing. I mean, they coerce you with taxation, they coerce you with licensure and a thousand other things. In fact, that was something I actually...
They don't coerce me with taxation, but except for sales tax, but they do coerce me with driver's license. But, you know, let me, this is a thought that's been on my mind for a long time. I'm going to give two thoughts that have been on my mind for a long time. Many years ago, before Waco, I'd look at cops, and I detested what they were doing. But I would look at the cop and kind of feel sorry for his family if he got killed. And after Waco, I didn't care about his family anymore. State of mind. Cops are abusive. They were the perimeter at Waco, the McLennan County Sheriff's Department, Waco PD, the DPS state troopers, and the Texas Rangers were the perimeter. And they were guarding the BATF and the FBI and all these other federal government agencies. And the other one, and this is things you have to consider. I know I have a right to bear arms, and I'm not looking forward to the day that the cop thinks that I don't have that right because he thinks he's got a right to shoot me, and I know I've got a right to shoot him. So, yes, there's an intimidation of force, but eventually we'll get to the point where we exceed them in commitment, both in terms of state of mind and in numbers willing to commit. And that's the point things really begin to change.
Yeah, that's pretty profound, I can only imagine. But, you know, speaking of so-called law enforcement, there's been a lot of in the news cycle at various times. I always see stuff where people are getting arrested for so-called victimless crimes and doing XYZ action without a license or disobeying the lawful orders of a peace officer. Or I know your personal favorite is resisting arrest.
Oh yeah, I mean people are arrested for resisting arrest. No crime was committed, and no cause for arrest except resisting arrest that was uncalled for. I mean, that's classic to me, and that's the epitome of what law enforcement has become in this country.
Right. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, are state citizens opposed to any law that is against personal injury?
That is against personal injury? Any law. Now, let's go back to when I proved that I don't need a driver's license to drive. When I was in court, I said, I object to these proceedings. I am the moving party today. I set forth this demand for habeas corpus. I cannot find an injured party. I need this court to direct the sheriff to bring forward the injured party with a sworn affidavit as to the injury. If this is civil rather than criminal, I need the sheriff to bring forward the injured party with the original of the contract I'm alleged to be party to and in violation of. That is personal injury. He ended up kicking me out of his courtroom. Get out of here is what it amounted to. And that's in What If I'm Arrested is the article that's in. But then I think the question centers on, are there laws that are that don't affect personal injury or damage to property or breach of contract that state citizens would accept? I would say yes, there are, because we have communities. Let's look at the nature of government. Excluding schools and churches and family, we've got the town government, the county or town or city government, the county government, the state government, and the federal government. Each of them has to have some degree of control over what happens. If we look at the federal constitution, we find certain things that you can't do. Counterfeit the coin of the realm. They're going to protect the rights of science and arts. Various things like that. State constitutions afford, originally, not now, I mean, some state constitutions have gone overboard in getting stupid laws on the books, but there has to be some autonomy, protection of state property, for example, certain laws on the highway, not licensing, but certain laws on the highway that make sense. For example, I had an accident in Pittsburgh many years ago. I was new to town. I had borrowed a car from a guy, and I turned left on a road. And I was going up, and I realized I'm on a one-way street going the wrong way. There's a garbage truck coming down, and I stopped, and he ran into me. He had a smile on his face, but he ran into me. Mm-hmm. Well, is it illegal to drive the wrong way on a one-way street, or is it illegal to have an accident while driving the wrong way on a one-way street? Now, I believe the second one is true because, well, I think we discussed something, the traffic control signals. They're traffic control. They're not law signs. They're traffic control devices, the speed limit. It doesn't say the law is you can't drive over 65 miles an hour. It says if you're going over 65, you're going to be found guilty. It makes it easier to make the determination of a cause of personal injury, but it's become a revenue activity for city and county governments. Seminole County, Florida took in $23 million in traffic fines in 1 year. That's a lot of money. That's a business. But other laws, for example, alcohol, prostitution, gambling, every town, every county has a right, and I think the county level is the top level, perhaps. Maybe some would go to state, for example, abortion or something that's broader still. But there were dry counties in the South. I was surveying in Georgia many years ago, back in the late 60s. And we were staying in this town that was a dry town. We were staying in a town that was in a dry county. And we drove about 15 miles. It was Christmas Eve. We were working up there over Christmas. We drove about 15 miles, had a few beers, bought a bunch of beers, brought them back, drank them in the motel room. The next morning next day when we got back from our field work, the manager of the hotel says, if I ever find a beer can in the trash can again, I'm going to kick you out of my motel. You can't have them here. That's a dry county. That's a prerogative of the county. Outlawing prostitution or gambling is a byproduct of the county. For example, prostitution is legal in most of Nevada. Las Vegas, can't think of the name of the county right now, but Las Vegas, that county, doesn't allow prostitution. But the rest of Montana, you drive through Montana and you see Bunny Ranch, Whorehouse, and all these things. Those are prerogatives of local communities to make an environment that's acceptable to them. So yes, laws can be that do not cause injury. But when we get to things like marijuana or heroin, the biggest crime of them is the fact that they're outlawed. Because if we're a free country, each man has a right to his own poison. And if he's doing that poison and causes a crime, he commits a crime against injury or property or contract, he's committed a crime. It shouldn't be compounded because he was on these. But it should be severe because he committed the damn crime in the first place. Doesn't matter what conditions prevailed. So, yes, there are laws that make sense to provide for the comfort of the community. But we have come over these last 4 or 5 decades, we have come to the point where the federal government dictates all. When I was young, Los Angeles had censorship committees. And they decided what could be censored. I always got a kick out of it. Let's watch that movie again. I want to see if we should censor that as pornography. But you had people that reviewed things and said, that's pornography. It was local. But then the federal government took over. They're homogenizing the whole thing. And that's not what the United States is intended to be. The states are supposed to have a high degree of autonomy, destroyed by the Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment primarily, or at least the groundwork. And at this point, they are little more than a means of Rand McNally indexing the roadmaps. But we need to restore, and the state of mind of state citizenship is necessary to get back to where we're supposed to be.
Well, I mean, from what you've described, I mean, there is a difference between mulla in se and mulla prohibita. I mean, mulla in se is, you know, are genuinely immoral acts, things like theft, kidnapping, murder, rape, and so forth. You know, these are common law offenses. Mulla prohibita is more the things you're kind of describing in a lot of ways. You know, something that violates a technical rule, a section of a code.
No, violates the well-being of the community.
Sure.
I think that's the way you have to look at it, because if I don't like this community that's dry, this county, dry county, I can move 15 miles to the other county and get drunk all I want.
If it's at the state level, sure. Although
no, some things might be at the state level, but these moral comfort laws for the comfort of our community have to be. There's two governments. There's a county. When a city incorporates, it actually steps outside of that county and creates its own laws. So you can have laws, and they should be less restrictive in the county than in the city. But if you had you couldn't drink in the city but could drink in the county, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
But that's a separate government. It's incorporated. It has its legislative, executive, and judicial branches to deal with things there. The county has executive, legislative, and judicial. The state has executive, legislative, and judicial. But go back to Jefferson. That government that's closest to us is the one that governs us best, because they know what we want collectively as this community, whether it be a city, a town, a county. And then when we get to the state level, perhaps some things should be applied at the state level. For example, abortion has always been, since 1810, has been a state prerogative, not a federal, but a state prerogative, until Roe versus Wade.
Of course, and the various problems with that, like stare decisis and a few other things. But I think what you're appealing to here is like voting with your feet. And if something is handled at the state government level or lower, that's one thing. There's at least that option to vote with your feet. But unfortunately, the federal government, the central government, really on the Potomac, they like to just completely outlaw things. You know, for instance, you can't, because of the Controlled Substance Act, you can't buy cannabis. Generally speaking, or, well, at least in one sense. And I also know that you can't sell raw milk in many areas.
Well, that's beyond. Now, there's a concept called the police powers of the state, and here we're getting back to the state thing. It used to be city had a health department, the county had a health department, then the state had a health department, and the state kind of took it away. They let the city and the county administer state health laws, and they can go a little further with the city or county laws if they want to, but basically the state became the foundation for health laws. And some of them are downright absurd when we consider how this country was established. You know, people lived in soddy houses with worms crawling out of the walls and spiders crawling on the roof. And now we can't even build a house on our own. It's gone too far. I mean, I'm a free man. I should be able to build any house that I want on my property. Now I can understand setbacks if I'm in a city, but not in a county. But you said voting with your feet, and I disagree with that because I shouldn't be forced to move. I vote with my community to establish the moral norms that we want within the community. I move to the community that I'm comfortable in, and then I want to retain the values of that community so I don't have to use my feet. So I think the perspective that you've put on it is the reverse of what it truly is, that we want to establish a community that's consistent with the moral values of the people in the community.
Well, at least in terms of mala prohibita, there's two like subclasses that I have kind of noticed. One is where things are outlawed completely, like with cannabis and raw milk, but the other one tends to be things that are law. So this kind of leads to my next question, really, which is that what is the state citizen's attitude towards licensure?
I have in my wallet a concealed carry permit issued by Florida in, I think it was 1989. I'm not going to pull it out. It was 1989 or 1990. Why do I carry that with me? Because I proved that I was competent. And I think it's fair that I'm competent to carry a concealed weapon. Do I want that to be annual, a revenue activity for the government and give them more and more authority? Look what's happening in Connecticut right now. You registered your gun, now you got to turn it in. They did that in California a few years back. If you have an AK-47, register it. It's okay, you can keep it. A year later, they were confiscating the AK-47s that were registered.
Yeah.
So licensing is, well, the legal definition of licensing in black is something like give you the right to do what would otherwise be illegal. Wait, how can it be illegal? Now, I can understand that I have to prove that I can drive a car. I understand that I have to prove that I'm competent to carry a concealed weapon. I understand that I have to prove that I'm competent to fly an airplane or various types of airplanes. And that should be a certification, not a licensure. And I should continue with that certification so long as I don't violate, by creating damage to somebody else, violate what I'm expected to do under that certification.
Yeah, you commit a tort, basically.
Right. And then it would be up to a jury to remove it, not to the government.
Not just through some administrative procedure or because, you know, some so-called peace officer decides to knock your door down at 3 a.m. with his team of thugs and so forth.
We don't want to go to that extent in this discussion. But a little earlier, I mentioned the police powers of the state, police powers of the city and county as well, and police powers of the federal government. Those are the ones that allow certain laws to be applied that have that moral or foundational. The Constitution, federal Constitution, lays out what those powers are very specifically. Many state constitutions early on laid out those power, the extent of those powers. And for the most part, police powers were left to the local community, the county, the city, or a town. Now, those police powers are for the comfort of the community. When they go beyond that, let's just say that some stupid city somewhere in Texas says, you can't use plastic bags when you go grocery shopping.
Oh, God.
That's going beyond the police powers that were ever conceived of being necessary for the comfort of the community. Those are social engineering, and social engineering is not what was anticipated when the concept of police powers of the community or the state or the county existed. So, but what they've done is incrementally increased the reach. And another good example, eminent domain. I'm very familiar with that. I worked both sides of eminent domain in Florida for the county when we took property, later on working for the people that were having property taken under eminent domain. And so I did a lot of research back then into eminent domain. And eminent domain is for the good of the community. So if we have to build the Erie Canal, the right of eminent domain to take the land to build the canal. We need a road that goes from here to there. The eminent domain for the good of the community. We have to dig a drainage ditch to drain the water so this land doesn't flood. Eminent domain for the good of the community. Everybody basically benefits by eminent domain. They don't benefit by increasing the tax base of a community like they try to do in Hartford, Connecticut. And we can look at how badly that fared. 12 years later, they never built this complex that was supposed to be this revenue source. So now there's this vacant land bringing no taxes in, and it had the reverse effect of their lying, saying eminent domain gives us the right to improve the property so we get a bigger tax base. This is going on the Agenda 21 right now. This isn't for the good of the public. This is stealing land. It violates the concept of centuries of what eminent domain is. So this is an extension of police power, and it's incremental because slowly we see the courts start favoring certain people over others, giving them economic benefit. And this is despotism. This is it. This is they're favoring the social superiority with their political superiority. And they're joining hands with the social and political superiorities at the expense of the average we the people, the voters.
Well, I mean, something that's always kind of bugged me, at least about licensure, is that, you know, like you defined it, it's a type of favor, undue favor of sorts. But it's provided you go and ask the government for permission. It's rather kind of sad if you actually go through all of the different activities they outlaw unless you get permission from them first. I mean, everything from what they call driving to marriage to, I remember when those folks put up Lemonade Freedom Day, and the reason they were doing that was because in certain areas you can't sell lemonade without a permit.
Well, we did when we were kids, and we did it on a main highway, and the cops were stopping by lemonade or Kool-Aid from us. I've gone to blacks now, and I want to make clear what a license is. Now, there are a number of definitions of license: executed license, executory, simple license, one revocable at the will of the grantor, one not coupled with a grant. Street and highways, permits to use street and highways, trade business and all that. But the principal definition, the first one in Black's Fifth, the permission by competent authority to do an act which, without such permission, would be illegal, a trespass, or a tort. So that's the definition of license. And if we're a free country, why should we have licenses? Certification is a whole different thing. It's proving competence. And generally, a certification isn't removed unless and until you've proven that you are no longer qualified to be certified to do that act. Okay.
Well, I know that you mentioned earlier about benefits. So if you accept benefits from the government, are you in fact accepting the terms and conditions of their perhaps unlawful adhesion contracts?
Well, we'll get into adhesion contracts in a second, but let's carry on from license, what we just talked about. If you accept benefits from the government, are you accepting terms and conditions? Well, let's see. License. I make application, so I'm asking the government to do something for me. They issue me a driver's license. I've sought a benefit. I'm accepting their terms and conditions by accepting that benefit. And if I violate those traffic control signs, which appear to be law signs the way they treat them, if I jaywalk in San Antonio, even. Well, wait, no, that doesn't have to do with driving, does it? I have accepted their terms and conditions. They can suspend, revoke, fine me, do all kinds of things because I sought that benefit. Now, that concept of benefit comes from Ashwander versus TVA, and you know, I think we'll get there in a little while. Now, as far as an adhesion contract, a lot of people in the Patriot community go a bit overboard with an adhesion contract. An adhesion contract is one that is fixed in form. You're stuck, you know, either take it or leave it. And a lot of people have that trouble with that concept. But suppose I'm selling oranges, and one orange is a dollar, and two dozen oranges is $5. That's an adhesion contract, too. I'm not going to barter the price, but if you buy two dozen, you get them really cheap. But if you buy one, you pay a dollar for it. So the idea of adhesion contract, I don't have to get a driver's license. I can drive without one. And actually, if I'd never gotten a driver's license, I'd probably be better off than I was when I got one because of things that have happened over the years. But if I'd known then what I know now, I would never have gotten a driver's license. But now I drive with one because it's more convenient than dealing with the courts over and over and over again. But in a way, getting a driver's license, calling it an adhesion contract is incorrect because you know the conditions and you say, yes, I want it. It's not something that's hidden from you. When you take the test, you have to obey the traffic signs. You have to do this. You have to do that. So you're fully apprised and you have a right of signing it or not. And it's not being forced upon you. It's just, unfortunately, most of us, when we get our driver's license, are naive, young, and the world's there. We're immortal and all these things exist. And we know everything in the world. And driver's license is the thing to do, which is what I did when I got mine. And so we sign a contract, not being fully cognizant, but knowing still, and especially now with driver training and all these prerequisites to get a license. But back when I did it, you know, you got a learner's permit and you drove with an adult and then you got a license. But even then, without all these classes, I knew that I was expected to abide by the traffic control devices. So it's not like it's a secret. You know, if you want to drive, here's the deal. The problem is we're a free country and we should be certified, not licensed for it. So,
are legal identification papers evidence of such contracts?
Legal identification papers, please. Not necessarily, because most states will issue a nowadays. Now, when I got a driver's license, it was typed on a piece of colored cardboard. Real thin cardboard. It was typed. No picture, nothing. All I had to do is get the blank, and I could have made my own license. You know, I couldn't duplicate the number, but the number assigned to me was typed in, too. Getting a license, making an application for something may have binding with it. But my understanding, I haven't gotten one, but my understanding is if you go down to get a photo ID issued by the state, I have not heard of anybody telling me or showing me that there's anything binding by that, because what they're doing is giving you a means of identification. So not necessarily, I think, is the answer to the question. But yes, they can be, you know, to be sure.
Okay, so what is the Ashwander Doctrine?
Well, I mentioned Ashwander just a minute ago, and Ashwander was a 1936, let me find my Supreme Court decision that was rather interesting. Justice Brandeis gave a concurring opinion, which means he agreed with the court, but he wanted to go a little further and explain something to us. And it was 1936 case, Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. It's at 297 U.S. 288. That's 297 U.S. 288, Supreme Court decision. Brandeis said in his concurring decision, the court developed for its own governance in the cases confessedly within its jurisdiction a series of rules under which it has avoided passing upon a large part of all the constitutional questions pressed upon it for decisions. They've avoided passing on a large part of all the constitutional questions pressed upon it for decisions. And then he says they are, one, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of legislation in a friendly, non-adversary proceeding, declining because to decide such question is legitimate only in the last resort. Two, the court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it. It is not the habit of the court to decide questions of a constitutional nature unless absolutely necessary to a decision in the case. Three, the court will not formulate a rule of constitutional law broader than is required by the precise facts to which it is to be applied. Four, the court will not pass upon a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there is also present some other ground upon which the case may be disposed of. This rule has found most varied application. Thus, if a case can be decided on either of two grounds, one involving a constitutional question, the other a question of statutory construction or general law, the court will decide only the latter. 5. The court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. Among the many applications of this rule, none is more striking than the denial of the right of challenge to one who lacks a personal or property right. That's called standing. Thus, the challenge by a public official interested only in the performance of his official duty will not be entertained. I'm going to interrupt here and point out if I were a soldier in Hitler's army and I was forced to do things that I thought were unconstitutional, the government had no authority, I could not challenge that and say, I don't want to do that. This kind of gives, you know, a question to what disobeying an unlawful order. I have no right to go to the court and say, is this constitutional? Is this a lawful order? Next, number 6, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute in the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. Now, I'm going to read number 7, then we're going to go back to number 6, because that's the significant one at this point of the discussion. But 7 is when the validity of an act of the Congress is drawn in question, and even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the question of constitutionality may be avoided. Oh, that's all the advice Brandeis gave us. But we'll go back to number 6. The court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. Now, all of these are the Ashwander Doctrine, but that one. Okay, now, if I make an application for a driver's license, I have availed myself the benefits of the statute on driver's licenses. So I can't challenge the constitutionality of that. I'm bound by the statute. So when we get to licensing, if I get that license, I'm bound by the statute, whether it's constitutional or not. I cannot question the constitutionality of the statute because I have sought a benefit from the statute. The issuance of a driver's license.
What are the administrative agencies?
Well, they're created by statute, aren't they? The Department of Motor Vehicles in your state, for example, is an administrative agency of the government of the state. Now, the Supreme Court, the state courts tend to follow the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court often imposes on the state court. So if in 1936 the Supreme Court said, if the one who avails themselves to a statute, there were already administrative agencies, and they were addressed in the Ashwander decision. They'd existed for a while. But in 1946, Congress adopted the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946, thereby creating extensive and laying the groundwork for extensive administrative agencies. Now, I don't know if they had driver's licenses before then or not, or maybe certifications, or maybe nothing. You didn't need anything to drive a horse. You probably didn't need it, may not have needed anything to drive a car. But the states picked up on the idea and created the Department of Motor Vehicles, issuing licenses and thereby binding you to statute rather than the constitutional right of the freedom of travel, the right to travel, which is assumed to be a right, though not enumerated, but existent among a free people. So the administrative agencies have become the means of despotic government that Thomas Jefferson told us about in the Declaration of Independence. They are outside the Constitution, and you can't even bring that back into the Constitution based upon what Brandeis told us in the Ashwander decision. And so what we've got, well, let's go back to the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946. It's rather interesting because the the sponsor of the bill, the guy that submitted the bill, I don't recall his name right now, but I do recall what he said. He said, we are creating a fourth branch of government, though it's not in the Constitution. I'm paraphrasing him, but he did say, though it's not in the Constitution, where the tripartite government was set up, we now have the legislative, the executive, the judicial, and the administrative branches of government. Now, that administrative branch, not being bound by the Constitution, created a despotic government. And this is the one, the despotism that that Jefferson was talking about in the Declaration of Independence. We have that despotic government, and we still believe that when the Supreme Court rules, they're saying the Constitution says this. What a misconception. But that's what administrative agencies are. They are the means of removing the Constitution from the relationship of us to most agencies of government.
Are United States citizens obliged to obey the regulations of the administrative agencies?
Well, that's a rather interesting question. If I have not sought a benefit under the statutes for that administrative agency, then I'm outside of Ashwander. Now, recently I tried to test that with the habeas corpus, and the court would not hear the case. From the district court all the way to the United States Supreme Court, they said, we don't want to hear this. We're not going to even listen to it. So I can't answer that question. I feel that I'm not, unless I create a relationship. For example, I was collecting Social Security. I'm bound by the rules of the Social Security Administrative Agency, but then I paid into that for 48 years, and I want some of that back out. But does that bind me to that other branches of government? I think not, and that's being tested right now because the IRS seemed to have taken my entire Social Security check, and we're right in the beginning throes of trying to determine what that relationship is. But I have not paid income tax since 1984.
Oh, good for you.
And so after 30 years, well, 29 years, I paid it in 84. I never paid in 85 on. So after 29 years, they're finally going to come after me. Almost half my lifetime I went without it. And now they're going to try and get me. And I think I might have been targeted because I guess I could be considered conservative by the current administration.
Are state citizens obligated to obey the regulations of the administrative agencies?
Well, here we come to that state of mind. I just explained my situation, my feeling. Now, does the fact that I'm a state citizen have any bearing on the Internal Revenue Service? I haven't even told them that I'm a state citizen. There's no reason to. I just told them I'm not a taxpayer. I'm not liable for income tax, and I don't have any income. The state of mind, though, however, gets me to understand that I have no obligation to that agency. So, again, it's that state of mind, that stage of the process of revolution that we're talking about, and how each of us deals with it is dependent upon what that person is willing to do. There's always risk with the Internal Revenue Service. They'll try and steal your property. They'll try and do whatever they can. And sometimes it's easier to go along with them, even though you know that you're not obliged to, rather than have to deal with the consequences of their imposition of despotic force upon you to try and get you to comply. There was a guy back in the early 90s, a guy named Carl Klang, wrote, to me back then, he was the balladeer of the patriot community, and he wrote some about the taxes, the Federal Reserve, 19 little children, I think, or whatever it was. But when I met Carl Klang, even though he said one of his songs talked about taxes being illegal, he admitted that, actually his wife admitted that Carl doesn't pay taxes. And my answer to her, and she felt embarrassed over this, but my answer was to her was quite simply, look, Carl does a good job singing, You know, he's the balladeer of the patriot community right now. I don't care if he pays taxes or not. You know, I would rather he devote his time to writing songs and playing those songs than messing with the IRS. I don't see any problem with this. And that's the way I feel. We've got to do what we feel comfortable doing. That doesn't affect the state of mind. It's acquiescence to the threat of imposition of force or theft that makes us decide which battles we want to fight and which battles we don't want to fight.
Well, one thing that's been on my mind is I wanted to ask you, what is the difference between a sovereign citizen, and a state citizen?
A sovereign citizen, a sovereign state citizen, and a state citizen. I don't know that there's any difference between a sovereign citizen and a sovereign state citizen. They're just throwing state in there to look important. But they're a world different than a state citizen. Sovereignty means master over all. Now, prior to the Civil War, the states assumed that they were sovereign in their relationship with the federal government, except to the extent that authority was granted to the state government. So it was kind of a watered-down sovereignty. So properly, it wasn't sovereignty, but it was expressed that way. Now, the people in the sovereign citizen or sovereign state citizen movements now think that they're immune from all law, state or federal. They assume that they're sovereign because, well, I'm not really sure why, because let's look at, we got two constitutions that affect us, the state constitution and the federal constitution. Well, let's look at the structure of government going from family all the way up to the federal government. There's a direction to this thing. So the state government. Well, when the state constitution was ratified, certain rights that would have been natural rights might have been conveyed to the state government. Grants of power via grants of power of authority, but then there were probably also limitations put on the state government. So those three elements, powers, authorities, and limitations, were given to the state government. The powers and authorities were a relinquishment of a degree of sovereignty. So we're not sovereign anymore. Same thing applies to the federal government. With the ratification by the states, via the states, we relinquished a degree of sovereignty in the powers and the authorities, and also imposed some limitations on the federal government. John Rowland, I've never met John, but I've talked with him many times, and we've had many discussions via email, and we had a discussion once about whether people were sovereign. And my answer, and this was disputed during the conversation, but he finally acquiesced, yes, we are sovereign. Accept what we've relinquished. But if we were not sovereign, how could we, the people, have ratified the Constitution and created a government? We had the absolute authority, and that was relinquished to the extents that I just mentioned. But we were sovereign to get there. So in a sense, we're still sovereign, like a king is when a king's got impositions on his sovereignty. So it's not true sovereignty, but it is the source of all authority. And in that sense, we're sovereign. But then the discussion with John is, he had to admit that we, the people, could not have created the Constitution if they weren't sovereign. But at the same time, I explained to John after we got done with that, the semantics of it, that I will never claim sovereignty as a right because I understand the relinquishment. But what I want to retain is what was not given to the government. And that's where I have a problem with the government. That's where the despotism comes in, because they've crossed that line. In fact, Ashwander aside, there was a ...1787... North Carolina Supreme Court decision that warrants our consideration in this regard. It was called Baird v. Singleton, 1787. It's one, which is the first book of North Carolina Supreme Court at page 42. One, North Carolina 42. Now, what had happened is North Carolina had a provision in the Constitution that you can't take property without due process and without compensation. Now, the legislature of North Carolina then enacted a law as the Tories were beginning to come back because the after the war, 1787, the year of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Tories had come back to reclaim their land. So the legislature passed a law that said Tories can't reclaim their land. So the Bayard and Singleton case was talking about whether the state legislature had a right to say you have no claim on your land. And what they said in the decision was, but that it was clear that no act of the legislature that they could pass by any means repeal or alter the Constitution, because if they could do this, they would at that same instant of time destroy their own existence, that being that government created by their Constitution, as a legislature, and dissolve the government thereby established. So the whole government gets wiped out if they pass an unconstitutional law because they have breached their contract. Now, this gets back to the whole concept behind the Declaration of Independence, John Locke's Second Treatise of Government, Chapter 19, or my article, Sons of Liberty, 14, that if they breach the contract, they have divested. And that's what Bayard v. Singleton said. Their act divested the people of any obligation to the government if they were able to pass laws in contradiction to the Constitution.
Is there a difference between a sui juris freeman and a state citizen?
The concept of freeman is one that holds land or has an estate. It's more of a social than a political position. But it sounds good, so let's call ourselves freemen. It was in most states, and in one Supreme Court decision, we're going back to the early 1800s, he was talking about voting rights. And voting rights in most of the states at that time required that you be a freeholder or a freeman. You had to own land, or you had to have an estate of 15 shillings was one of them. And it varied from state to state. But that means if I owed 50 shillings, but I had 65 shillings, I had 15 shillings, but I had to own more than I owed. That was what the estate was, settled estate, was your final financial status. So if I'm buying a house and I paid $100,000 on a $200,000 house and I only got $20,000 in the bank, I'm not a free man. So free men then had to do with social status and the right to vote. And so this concept of sui juris, by right, free man, and a state citizen, they're worlds apart. I don't know what a sui juris freeman is, because I know what freeman is, and that's somebody with an estate in life. He's earned a place in society, as opposed to the beggar, the welfare recipient, the many government employees, TSA, people like that.
Is there a difference between a lowercase citizen of the United States and an uppercase citizen of the United States?
Well, from a legal standpoint, no. But if we go to the Constitution and look very closely, let me find my little Constitution. I just had it a minute ago. There it is. We find reference to citizen of the United States in the Constitution, and we find it occurring again in the 14th Amendment. In the Constitution, they're talking about the citizens of one of the members of the Union, and they use an uppercase C. Now, in the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are lowercase citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So this is a lower state citizen, lowercase citizen in the 14th Amendment. So it's a way of, in discussion, for example, or in writing, to distinguish between the two, because historically the writing supports lowercase as the 14th Amendment, and prior to that, the uppercase ones that are addressed two or three times in the Constitution, maybe more. But is there a legal distinction if I write Gary Hunt, citizen with uppercase C of the United States, versus writing citizen of the United States lowercase? Is there any legal distinction? I don't think the courts are going to recognize that any more than they recognize the difference between your name being upper and lowercase letters, or all uppercase letters, what's called in rem. So it might be fun, but it's only good from a concept of understanding what we're talking about when we're talking about these two different entities, citizen of the United States, uppercase being one of the a citizen of one of the member states or a state citizen, and the lowercase version, which is the 14th Amendment citizen. But no, legally, no. In concept, though, a very distinct difference, because one was never subject to the jurisdiction of the federal government, and the other one has always been subject to the jurisdiction of the federal government.
Why do the sovereign citizens avoid mentioning the administrative agencies?
Well, I guess the same reason that somewhere along the line, a lot of people looked up in the air and saw contrails and said, those must be chemtrails. They see something and they define it to suit themselves. If they're not aware of administrative agencies and they believe it's a corporate United States or maritime jurisdiction or admiralty law, they're hinged on that. They don't want to give up that misbelief. But in fact, those are so ambiguous, they can't tie down what maritime law they're under. There are maritime laws, laws of the sea. There are admiralty laws, again, laws of the sea, a little different in nature. There is no corporate United States, even though the United States has a corporate capacity. So they're trying to blame it on one of these three things, not really understanding a relationship. But in the Supreme Court decisions, we see a relationship, what our relationship is, where the damage comes from. Anybody who seeks to benefit from a statute is bound by the statute. And when they say statute, that means the whole statute, the whole motor vehicle code, for example, the whole Internal Revenue Service code, Title 26. So one's easy to explain, but for some reason people are caught up and they don't want to unbelieve what they've believed for so long and been told by so many people. But the interesting thing about being told by so many people, and Sleepy, you're aware of this one, there were, what, over 40,000 hits of Gary Hunt, John Doe 4?
Yes.
But there were perhaps four or five articles, and all of them emanated from one article and had the same elements, just some people rewrote them. Other people just regurgitated this stuff. So this quantity, I see John Doe 4, or I see corporate United States or maritime jurisdiction or admiralty jurisdiction, so many times that, damn, there's got to be something wrong here. That's got to be it, because, man, look at how many people have been telling me that this is true when I read their work. So they have become obsessed. There's no remedy shown in admiralty jurisdiction, maritime jurisdiction, or this corporate relationship with the United States. They can't find a way out, but they have accepted the premise, where the premise on the other is explained in the Supreme Court decisions. Incrementalism over a couple centuries, we've seen a transition where administrative agencies in 1946 were empowered to write laws and try and despotically impose them on us. So why should they mention chemtrails until they look up and see that there's contrails up there?
Well, with your John Doe 4 example, I think what you're pointing out there is essentially the phenomenon of because YouTube said so. You mean, even Ben Lowery pointed out that the reason a lot of this proliferated as much as it has is because, quite frankly, it's been done by way of that kind of repeating effect of misinformation.
Well, I prefer to say guess what I know mentality, because well, I explained to you once about Joyce Riley and the corporate United States, that Randy was going to have Joyce on the show and he wanted me to help him interview her to see if she had a legitimate story. And so I wrote that little worksheet up, and it's on the internet now, and you know, we can provide a link to it. But she said she was a researcher, and I said, do you have any of the original documents? For example, the Act of 1871 that everybody claims is proof that there's a corporate United States. And she said, no. And I said, well, where did you get your information? She said, well, I've read other people's work, but I rewrote it in my own words. Well, that's not a researcher. If you haven't read the Act of 1871 that created the corporate Washington, D.C., 10 miles square, defined in that act, you know, 10 miles square, the same thing that's in the Constitution. If you haven't read that, you're not a researcher. You're just passing on what somebody else said. Guess what I know? This is a corporate United States. Why do you believe that? Well, I read it 16 times, and everybody's saying the same thing, so it must be true. I guess that's what they're doing.
Wow.
Well, but is the guess what I know mentality is the dangerous aspect of this whole thing, because they're convinced that they're right. And some people even write books paraphrasing other people's work and sell the books. So there's proliferation of misinformation. And until people get back on track and understand what's really wrong, they don't know how to really write it. Let's get rid of the U.S. corporation. Okay. Well, it's not there, so it's gone. Let's get rid of maritime and admiralty jurisdiction. Well, if you look in U.S. code, it defined the limits of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction being certain navigable waterways, bays, harbors, and out to sea. But it doesn't ever come on land unless that land is sometimes dry and sometimes inundated. So the limitations, we can't get rid of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, because they don't work up here on dry land. No matter what people tell you, if you read U.S. Code, maritime jurisdiction, you'll see that it only applies in certain places, and dry land ain't one of them, unless it's only dry occasionally.
Yeah, well, I doubt those folks would even bother going on to the government printing office or GPO's website and even looking at the U.S. Code, and I have.
Well, let me... You know, you've heard many of the things my father's told me over the years. He was good at understanding human nature, and I learned a lot from him. But one, he told me that, and you have to put this in context of other situations, but he said when somebody has a car, no matter how bad the car is, if they have that car and like it, it's the best car in the world until they're ready to get rid of it, and now it becomes the worst car in the world. But at one moment in time, it went from the best car in the world to the worst car in the world. Now, people are holding on to that ragged old car that just won't run anymore because it's the best car in the world. They don't want to give it up and call it the worst car in the world. And that's corporate United States, maritime, and admiralty jurisdictions. They're clinging to that car desperately. They don't want to give it up.
Yeah, I just find it rather interesting, like when Ben Lowery mentioned about all these lectures and videos of all these folks pushing the corporate United States myth, not one of them ever mentioned the administrative agencies, not once.
Oh, they sure like that old car, don't they? Beat up and ragged, not even running anymore. They have never made it run successfully, but they're still grasping at straws. Not straw men, but straws.
Yeah, a little bit of an in-joke there, right?